The following podcast is not relating to my teachings and work at Del Cid Medical Center and is for entertainment purposes only.
All right, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Life of Flow podcast. Today, we were very fortunate to have a very good friend, co-fellow of mine and trainee.
Ex-trainee.
Dr. Jerry Kim. He is a private vascular surgeon in Pomona, California. And today, we go into his vision of what he wanted for himself after finishing training. He was very clear that he wanted to be an independent solo practitioner, and he basically accomplished what he wanted to do. So he's going to walk us through the ins and outs, the how-to of kind of going out of training and establishing your own practice.
Jerry, Jerry's kicking ass and taking names out there, so I'm very proud of him.
Yeah.
I'm very proud of him. And actually towards the tail end, you'll realize that we've also elected Jerry to be maybe the third musketeer of maybe some future programs, because I think he's very colorful and very insightful. So stick around.
Thanks.
Two vascular surgeons walk into a bar and come out with a podcast. We are talking everything vascular and not. Welcome to the Life of Flow podcast.
Are you avoiding showing your legs because of varicose veins? Worry no more. At Hope Vascular and Podiatry, we have the solution. Our vascular specialists are ready to rid you of those pesky varicose veins. Regain your confidence and enjoy life without complexes. Call 346-400-4673 or visit our website at www.hcic.io. Because at Hope Vascular and Podiatry, the new normal is you better.
We are recording here from the beautiful, hippie, unclear, very, right now, paralyzed city of Austin, Texas. Paralyzed because South by Southwest is here. So there is a lot of idiots in the street a lot. Last night we went to dinner and it was full of fucking drunk people and high people, and it was really an uncomfortable moment. Anyway,
I'm glad you like coming here.
I hate coming here. I love coming to visit Lucas, but I hate having to come every 2 months. Anyway, today, as I spoke in the intro, Jerry is here talking with us, and Jerry, as is also Lucas, is one of the guys that did the vascular surgery fellowship training. So after general surgery, did fellowship training in vascular surgery at Baylor when I was there and attending, and it was a super pleasure to work with these guys. It was fun. They had good hands, good patient care, everything you can ask of a trainee, and then some very particular personalities too that were very colorful. And for me, it was great. But one of the things that I do, when I was still doing a lot of trainee work, I would see that when it comes to the last year, most of them are dazed and confused. And it's like, deer in lights, right? You start telling them early on, it's like, hey, have you started looking for a job? Like, are you out there? Are you to interview? And, let me help you with your deal. Show me the contract. And most people are very lost in that sense. They have no idea. They don't know where to start. They don't know where to go. But one of the things that was really, really interesting about Jerry was he was laser focused. Like, he knew exactly what he wanted to do. He was laser focused about what his family needs were, about what his wife's intentions and needs were, which probably makes him the smarter of us three. But very clear on what the model of what he wanted to, and also understood the geography. And so I think that's a great, topic about, how do you maneuver decision-making there towards the end? And then the hardships or just the journey through getting to be able to materialize that particular plan. And it seems to me from the outside that you have been able, Jerry, to do it. But but maybe you haven't. And maybe, and since we haven't really caught up in a while, it's going to be great to hear this story firsthand. The last thing I remember was being, you know, doing some of the last cases in the angio table and you having this plan of moving to California and doing private practice. And this is how I want to do it. But that's where I left it. And so I guess I'd love to kick it off with that. I mean, what happened after training? What did you do? And has it been evolving as you thought it would be? And let's use the time we have with you here today to talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, when I was at the end of fellowship, honestly, the thing I wanted the most was independence. You know, I spent an entire decade of having people tell me what to do. And the one thing I wanted was I just wanted to do it myself. And if I was gonna screw things up really bad, I wanted it to be my decision and I would own the repercussions of those mistakes. And that's exactly what's happened to me since I've left fellowship. Okay. So the first thing I wanted was I wanted to be the only vascular surgeon. I did not want to join a group of four or five guys with some 60-year-old dude at the top telling me when to take call, what cases I was going to do. Oh, my graft is infected. You're going to take care of this. That is the last thing I wanted. My wife had to be in California. She was from California, and fellowship was the first time she was out of state. And 3 months in, we got hit with Hurricane Harvey. And she said, you know what? There's no way we're living here. In fact, she moved back to California 4 months before I was even done with fellowship. She said, I can't do this anymore. When you move out here, we'll be together again. I'm taking the kids. I'm leaving. So for the last 3 months of fellowship, she wasn't even in Houston anymore.
Sounds like Bernardino.
So anyways, I wanted to be independent. I wanted to be on my own. So, and I had to be in California. So I sought a job where I wasn't joining a group of other vascular surgeons. So I found this job in Pomona, California. And Pomona is kind of an underserved area of Los Angeles County. It's on the eastern edge of LA County. There weren't really any other vascular surgeons in this area. I joined a large medical group where I would be the only vascular surgeon. And this job was perfect for me, I felt at the time, because this large group had a lot of primary care doctors, hospitalists, cardiologists. They promised me that all of these people in the group would directly feed patients to me. So it was a job where I didn't have to worry about drumming up business. I didn't have to worry about the business aspect of private practice, at least during those first 3 years. So I did 3 years with this group. And my ultimate goal was always to move out of the group after those 3 years and do true private practice. So in my mind, true private practice is a practice that you own and nobody else owns. You control all of the money, you control all the decision making, you control which hospitals you go to, and you control which patients you operate on. And at any point in your practice, you can say, you know what, I don't want to do that. I don't want to treat that patient. I don't want to go to that hospital. I don't want to take call on these days. So at the end of the 3 years, I broke outside of the group and set up my own practice. And this whole time I've been solo. It's been just me.
How many years has it been since you did that?
So I did that in August of 2022. So it's been about a year and a half since I finished my 3-year employment contract with this medical group.
Where were we in the pandemic?
The pandemic hit about 6 months into when I started my job.
Fuck.
Yeah.
When you started your job, not when you broke out to private.
Yeah.
Correct.
Okay.
Which was perfect. It was just absolutely perfect timing.
Why?
Yeah, I mean, because
because I'm collecting a salary.
Yeah.
And I'm just sitting on my ass doing nothing. You know, I was doing like 3 cases a week at the height of the pandemic. Yeah. And I was collecting a salary. It was amazing, I'll be honest. And you know, I'm actually very thankful to my medical group. If I was in charge of the medical group, I probably would have said, you know, this is nonsense. We're paying all these surgeons a full salary. They're not doing any cases. We're taking huge losses. But, you know, they never even brought it up. So I am very thankful to the medical group.
and the guys in the group are thankful you weren't the director of the group.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, this is true. Yeah. So anyways, I've been doing this for a year and a half, completely on my own as a solo practice. During that time, I set up my own office. I established contracts with the IPAs, HMOs, and insurances in this area. I had to hire staff.
How was that process? Walk us through a little bit of that, setting up contracts. Is it difficult? Is it annoying?
Yeah, all of the above. So, you know, if you think about this from the perspective of the insurance company, they don't want a vascular surgeon. They don't want any specialty surgeons on their panel. What they want is they want their existing general surgeons to kind of deal with everything. That's what these insurance companies really like, because they are able to contract very low rates with general surgeons, typically 70 to 80% of Medicare rates. And so they want their general surgeons to just take care of everything. And these general surgeons tend to be older, late career. You know, they're not like us where they're saying, well, this is not fair. You're paying me less than Medicare rates. So that's what they want. They don't want a specialty surgeon on their panel, because a specialty surgeon tends to cost more. They do more specialized procedures. They typically demand a higher rate than a general surgeon. So they don't want that. So that's the first hurdle. The second hurdle is, it's almost like working with the DMV. All right. These insurance companies purposefully, I swear, I think they go to the DMV and they say, hey, we're going to pay you more to work for us, because the paperwork and the emails and the acting like they never spoke to you for months at a time is just incredible. It's incredible. So it takes around 6 to 12 months just to get a contract with some of these HMOs and IPAs in the area. And typically, you just have to wait. You just have to wait until a lot of these insurance companies and IPAs realize there truly is a need for your services. You know, they have multiple patients that have to be sent to tertiary care centers because they have complications or some, you know, vascular issue that is not being addressed, until they finally realize that they need you. So a lot of it is just time. And I even have a lot of HMOs and IPAs kind of adjacent to my geographic area that I don't have a contract with. I've asked and they say, no, we don't need you. But, you know, 8-12 months go by and then they reach out. They say, hey, would you like a contract? So it's just a matter of time. The area that I picked because there isn't market saturation for vascular surgeons here. So if you go to Santa Monica, Beverly Hills, Orange County, you have these groups of 7-8 vascular surgeons. There's nothing like that here. Nothing.
And the problem that poses, Lucas, is that, for example, for me, it didn't matter that I had been in the community for 8 or 10 years and that I've been doing all this work and that I'm like really good and that I talk at a meeting or whatever. They don't care at all. I was a new tax ID and I was a vascular surgeon in the middle of a place where within 2-mile radius, there's probably 30 vascular surgeons.
Yeah.
So I got contracts to, you know, I got spat in the face, right? I didn't even take Cigna. Cigna offered me 80% Medicare. So I was like, fuck it. I'm not taking Cigna. I'm going to be out of network. And then until there was, for whatever reason, I was able to, because that's the other thing is there's this game you play, because a lot of these patients go to the ED. Mm-hmm. And then once they're in the hospital, it's all fair game, yeah. Right? I mean, if the patient's right. in the hospital, right. and the hospital is, and I have a relationship and I'm on call or whatever that is, I will take care of that patient's needs. Yeah. And then I have the capacity to have an out-of-network patient. And then my office needs to be doing all this dealings in the back. And then it gets to the point where they realize, oh man, we're paying him a lot, because when it's out of network, I can essentially charge whatever I want because it's out of network, right? Because I can tell them, listen, you remember when you were giving me 80%? I actually send them a bill for 250%. And because it's out of network, they have to pay. So it's really actually almost juicy to have some out of network patients, because there's really no disagreement and they can't say. So then what happens is you get two or three of those in a row, and then they come back and they say, okay, listen, Linda, let me give you a contract for 115 or 1730%, whatever that is.
Yeah.
But it's really hard when you don't do it like Jerry did in a much thoughtful, analytical way. So that's something important for those of you out there considering private, is remember that when you start from zero, you start from minus zero, not zero alone, especially in a,
so
in a high prevalence.
Did you wait to leave the group you were with before getting those contracts?
Yeah, so the one thing that worked for me was during those 3 years that I was with the group, I set up a kind of a referral pattern. So from within the hospital, I was really the guy. So if there was anything vascular, it would immediately come to me from within the hospital. And then from the surrounding areas, the primary care doctors, family medicine doctors began to send me all of their patients. And I captured the nephrologists very early on. So there were two major nephrology groups in the area, about 20 nephrologists. And I was able to shift, I would say, at least 90% of the referrals toward me within those two groups.
Only by geography, right? I'm guessing that was it?
Largely by geography.
This is the third podcast today that I keep insisting that you build your center of excellence where the patients are.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Like I love the big buildings in Austin, but as you are creating this, please think out of the box, go where they are and build your patient center of excellence there. It could be a hospital that's helping you do it, but they won't come here, right? You build it there. And the moment that you build it there, they flock.
Yeah.
That's so true. So just by virtue of me being here and just sitting around, I developed a referral pattern from in the hospital and on an outpatient basis. So at the end of the 3 years, I already had all of these patients coming toward me. So when I left the group, really the only threat was if my medical group decided, well, we're going to hire another vascular surgeon to replace you, then I would have been completely screwed. I would not have been able to build this practice because I would have just been replaced with another guy. But I knew that wasn't going to happen because when I took this job, I knew that this position had been vacant for about 3-4 years. They had not been able to recruit a vascular surgeon. And who's gonna show up to an underserved area as a solo vascular surgeon? Who's crazy enough to do that anyway, straight out of training, right? That's just bizarre. Most people don't do that. And I realized this when I tried to recruit a second guy to join me. Nobody wanted to join me for the same reason. And I'm like, I'm the only crazy idiot that did this. Nobody else is stupid enough to do it with me. Luckily, I found someone to do this with me. But, I knew they weren't going to be able to hire another vascular surgeon.
But hey, I don't know, whoever you are, when you listen to this podcast, you can be fine, man. You're going to be fine.
Okay.
You can make bank. It's good. Don't quit on Jerry right now.
It's okay,
boy. We'll wait. We'll release it until he comes.
Exactly.
No worries. Your secret is...
So, when I left, I was in a very, very unique position. I think most people would not find themselves in this position. And it was partially strategic because I knew I would be in this position. But when I left my medical group and I set up my own practice, I knew that there was nowhere else for these patients to go other than to come to my new practice. So basically, I just called up all of the HMOs and IPAs. And what I first said was, hey guys, I changed my tax ID number. Can you just change the TIN on the contract?
I bet you got a big fat fuck you in return.
Yeah. Well,
yeah.
Well, a couple IPAs actually said, sure, that's no problem.
Oh, and they incredible.
They actually did that.
Yeah.
But yeah, the majority of them said, no, 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 that's not how it works.
Yeah.
But then I told them, I said, well, this is how it works because I was the other TIN and now I'm this new TIN and there's no vascular surgeon at that old TIN anymore. So what are you going to do? So eventually they all rolled over into my own private practice.
Oh, that's incredible.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
Who knew you were such a like a Machiavellian planner, I guess.
Everybody knew.
Yeah,
come on.
Yeah.
You could see the writing on the wall.
That's awesome.
What?
Yeah, but that's the hardest part. For me, it was easy because everything was just kind of set up in my favor. But that's probably the hardest part of true private practice.
But you know, this is something very interesting for those out there toying with the idea. Maybe they're 12 months out or 15 or 6 months out. I think you need to remove yourself from this thought that the only place you can succeed at is these big facilities. I am really telling you, I took the Kool-Aid, I drank it, and then I guess part of it because of where I come from, and I realized looking at the scenario, it just didn't make sense to me. Aortas are disappearing. Carotids are disappearing. Legs are on the rise. Fistula and axes are on the rise. And we become a commodity of outpatient care, right? I mean, so the closer we are to the patients, the better the lifestyle we can have, the better we can be in the driver's seat. And then, you know, honestly, if you play your cards right, you're going to make enough bank to whenever you want, you take a vacation to, go to the wonderful cities of the world. But the reality is the inside of an OR looks the same wherever you are, right? And so I really think that you have to think hard and about, you know, what's your goal? And I do realize, and here's the other, I do realize, Jerry, you are very special, and Lucas, you too, that you guys were very advanced. You had like really good hands. And there are people that aren't to that level when they graduate, and they would probably be doing their communities a disservice by going out there straight up, right? And I see the value in saying, hey, I'm going to stay and I'm going to take another academic position because there's this growth that I still need to go through for the first year or two.
I went through a lot of growth in my first year. I mean, I am very grateful that I found myself with Mark Davies, which we interviewed before, in San Antonio, because, you know, it took me a good 2 years to feel like, okay, I can tackle absolutely. I didn't feel like that straight out. And I know that I had the support to get myself out of trouble when I didn't even know I was getting in trouble.
Do you think you missed that, Jerry? Do you think it would have been cool for you to be at whatever, not Baylor, because you're probably mentally peaced out, but let's say UCSF for a year, UCLA for a year, and then go to this. Do you think there would have been any benefit in retrospect?
So, you know, for me, when I was finishing fellowship coming out into practice, call it ego or arrogance, but I felt like I would have zero problems going into practice, middle of nowhere. As the only vascular surgeon, I felt like I could deal with anything. No problem. I'm going to figure this out. And when it actually happened to me, I was like, oh, no, this was a huge mistake. Okay. there were times where I was like, what the hell did I do? This was dumb. But, you know, I had this ultra steep accelerated growth as an independent vascular surgeon, because I put myself in that position. It was like ultra private practice boot camp where, you know, I got all these tough cases. You know, I was asked to do spine exposure during my second week. My first ever case was a cardiologist was doing a TAVR, had like a 20 French sheet, then somehow got yanked out. And now he was just dying on the table. So, you know, I get called to take care of these things and I feel really up in over my head, but you know, you just stick to the basics and you figure it out. And when you do that without anybody else that you can call, I think you mature at an incredibly fast rate. And I felt just like Lucas after I started this. I didn't feel like Lucas before I started it. Before I started, I felt like I could tackle the world. When I actually got into it, I felt just like Lucas. I was like, you know what? I think I need someone to help me. But I didn't have anyone. So I had to just help myself. And after about 6 months of that, I felt more comfortable. After a year of that, I felt very comfortable. And after 2 years, I think Lucas's timeline is spot on. After 2 years, I truly felt, you know what, I really can deal with anything that comes through those ER doors. I think 2 years is exactly right. 2 years being in private practice.
And I went through the same exact thing. And I think that I think it's everybody goes through it. And I think it's not necessarily learning the surgery, because you've been there, right? You've helped in enough, or you've done enough as a primary. It's you're learning yourself, and right. you're learning your environment. And I remember, I don't know if you guys were there when I, but the more that I worked at Baylor, the more that I started fine tuning the idea of it's about the control you have of your environment. And that comes from knowing how to set the table, from knowing what, you know, what pickups work for you, what the length of the dumb prolines, right? I mean, I know that's dumb, but like I would go ballistics if they would give me these long prolines that like I would have to like raise my hands to do knots with. Because if you're alone, you have to follow yourself, man. A lot of times you have to just do it yourself. And I remember that I had this whole thing where I would follow myself during fistula work, because that came from when I was alone in private practice in Tucson and I had nobody to help me. And so you just realize all these little ways and back doors, and then you become very, you know, you just help yourself. But there's this learning that happens, either be it in academic practice or be solo wherever you are. There is this absolute learning curve that you go through. And then you kind of find your comfort space. And it's not only about surgery. It's also about who you want to operate on, right? I think you also, at the beginning, you're like, you kind of say yes to everything, and then you realize that some you should just walk away from. It's okay. And that's another really important thing, right? I always say you come out a good operator, but you become a good doctor within a couple of years.
Yeah, 100%. So did the business part of it not like intimidate you? Like when you were like the actual managing a business, like did you have any training in any like the art of running a practice, numbers, budgets?
Was running some like international clothing business shit or something like that before.
What?
No, that was me.
Who was that? That was your sister. What did your sister do?
My sister has, I think, an economics degree from Yale and an MBA from Stanford. Okay. So she's like the classically trained business person.
She's the smart one in that family.
Yeah,
and she had set up some kind of wedding dress business.
See?
She
got clothing. I knew it.
Yeah, she actually got venture capital money to do this. And then the whole thing went bankrupt during COVID. So.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, I had no training. I had no clue. I still kind of have no clue, and I'm kind of learning. But here's what made me confident I could do it. When I was working for the medical group, I, you know, had some meetings with them, and I said, hey, show me some numbers. What's my productivity like? How much revenue am I generating? What's my operating costs? You know, what's the overhead? What are the margins? What's the accounts receivable? What's left on the table here? What are you going after? What should I be doing more of? What should I be doing less of? You know, I had all these meetings with them, and they were just clueless, okay? I mean, literally, some of these meetings went like, okay, we want you to do less colonoscopies. And I was like, are you fucking kidding me? Do you realize that I don't do any colonoscopies here? And they said, oh, a lot of these cabbages aren't bringing in that much money. And I was like, this is unbelievable. I wanted to walk out of some of these meetings. Those meetings told me I could do this. Okay. Yeah. I was like, if these guys can do this with 250 physicians for the past 40 years, there is no way I'm going to fail. Okay.
I have been saying this so many times in this podcast, Jerry, is the moment that we let the C-suite grow in all hospitals and everything.
Yeah.
We were led to believe that we are so fucking clueless and dumb.
Correct. Yeah.
That we can never interpret an Excel spreadsheet.
Yeah.
Or that we have no basic business acumen capabilities. But dude, I'm telling you that is what you need to run this is what you need to actually run a gas station. You know, it's $3 for the beer. You gave me $5. I got to give you $2 back. Got it. Right. And the exchange is done. It is that simple. This is not rocket science, but we have been led to believe that we can do it. And not only that, but then when we're brought into these meetings, to Jerry's point, we're told we're so underproductive. We're shown multiple like pages of how, you know, you don't even meet your quota, your RVUs are dumb, like all these things. It is beyond all reasoning that we have been led to believe that we cannot be in this position. It is completely and utterly dumb. And I invite anybody out there, please, you can do this. It's very basic math. You don't even need to, like, you can do it with a calculator. It's very basic.
Yeah.
So what's the, so there's going to be a time interval between your, you know, your golden cuff salary and generating money. Right. What in your experience has been that interval? And could you say how much would you recommend someone have in reserve to be able to support yourself during that time?
So this is the most important question. I think most physicians are extremely risk averse. And by the time you finish your training, you have a family and you know, you're well into your 30s. The thought of going without income for sort of an unknown duration is really, really scary to, I think, any physician. And I think this is the sort of hump that people cannot get over. It is the sole reason people decide to just continue collecting a salary and working for the suits. This interval is the most important thing. That's always what people want to know. Is it going to be 6 months? Is it going to be a year? I've seen people quoted as long as 3 years. So for a vascular surgeon making a median income in California, and that median income in California right now is $455,000 a year. Okay. I just looked it up with the hospital to decide, you know, how much is a vascular surgeon worth? So in California, a median income for vascular surgeon is $455,000 a year. Question is always, how long is it going to take me to get to that 455? That's a really complex question. I would say almost anybody will get to that point given enough time, but that time interval is purely based on the supply, demand, and laws of economics in the area that you're in. So for someone like me, who was really the only vascular surgeon in this immediate area, who just simply essentially changed TINs, I knew that interval was going to be short. And I expected that interval to be about 6 months. Turns out that interval was about 2.5 months for me. But I was constantly told 6 months, 6 months, maybe 12 months. You need enough money in the bank to pay your mortgage and, you know, pay your kids' tuition, I think, for 6 to 12 months. I think that's the safe way to do it.
I would advocate for a year.
Yeah.
That's the super safe bet.
Yeah. But
a year is a super safe
bet. Determined by the market, where you are, what things are like.
Well, also not only the market year, but also your bleed, right? What's your bleed rate?
Yeah.
Right.
So if you come in it with, you know, a very exuberant lifestyle, and you love eating expensive sushi and you have a couple of Porsches and you have four kids and they're all in private school, well, you're kind of fucked. So whatever that is, you have to just, you know, you have to look at it that way, or you dial back, right? I mean, what's the first thing I did? You remember that?
You were going to buy a very expensive car, and then I never heard about it after.
Well, the first thing I did the day that I quit was turn in the 911 and pick up a pickup. That's it. It's the first thing I did, and I cut by 66% my my bleed on a monthly rate. Like, it was something like that on cars, you know, like, and then I went home and I told, you know, my wife, I was like, okay, I know you like going to like HEB, we're going to Fiesta. You know, you got to do what we got to do, right? I mean, this is contraction. And if you can't bootstrap yourself, then do this.
Yeah.
Because you're going to have some miserable days.
Yeah.
And what about the, like, the build? Because, you know, people can build. You went for a big build. Seems like Jerry went more lean. What's the pros and cons?
Oh, I mean, I think lean is the way to go, especially when you don't know what your revenue is going to be. I mean, I went so lean that I didn't even have an office or a medical assistant when I started. Okay. I was, you know, basically couch surfing on a professional basis. I was borrowing office space from a friend for a very low rate, and I had one employee. That employee did front office stuff, back office stuff. She acted as the MA during my clinic days. I went ultra, ultra lean because I knew, like Miguel said, the bleed rate is key. So from a professional standpoint, my bleed rate was probably as low as humanly possible. And then when I started to see the revenue, I was like, okay, I can hire an MA. Okay, you know what? I can get my own office. Oh, you know what? I can get a pretty big office. Oh, you know what? I can build an OBL. So, you know, lean is the way to go. I went super, super lean. Really, you only have to ask yourself, what do I absolutely positively need? And if you think about it, you don't really need anything. You can borrow office space. You can even borrow staff. You can go to an office and say, I want to borrow your office and your staff for 6 hours a week, please. They're not going to ask you for much. You go in there 6 hours a week, start seeing patients, do your cases at the hospital.
How do you deal with the EMR or with the records?
I have an EMR that's $49 a month.
Oh, wow.
And I like it.
Yeah.
You know, it works for me.
Yeah. That's just,
you know, there's billing services out there that'll do 3%.
I was gonna say the I think there are, for example, Athena, which is where we're probably migrating to. It throws the EMR, and it's a really robust EMR. But you negotiate then the billing percentage. So with Athena, for example, we would negotiate whatever 4%, 5%. Of what comes in, but then we get this really robust CMR. And to give you a perspective, Epic can cost you like 20 or 30 grand a month.
Yeah. Jesus Epic's Christ. Outrageous.
And I mean, like a month.
Yeah. How do they sell that to?
They don't care. It's corporate. For them, they're locked into the big systems. That's Cerner and Epic and all those are big systems. What you see in private practices, you know, Net Health, I don't know, Athena, Clinical, eWorks. What's the name of the one you use?
I use Practice Fusion.
It sounds like some.
Yeah. What are the?
It's like you ordered Epic on Wish.
Yeah. you went for a bigger build. What was your thought process instead of going lean?
I had the only way that I can survive in the Houston Medical Center is by competing with the big boys. And so, for me, the difference was I was coming from a place of, okay, I've got the name and the reputation and the volume. Mm-hmm. And I drew very, 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 conservative pro formas. Mm-hmm. And it was obvious to me that I could sustain that level. The other thing that I did is I differentiated. So I don't only have the vascular revenue but I have wound care. I have hyperbarics and podiatry, which if managed appropriately, there's a significant revenue with like skin substitutes in the outpatient setting and some other stuff like that. So we build a more differentiated limb preservation performer, particularly. He was building a vascular integrative practice. It was a little bit different, I think.
And Jerry, did you get any, like, there are these companies that help you like build a practice?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, these companies are...
I protected you.
You did. Yeah. I had a really key phone call with Miguel. And
yeah.
So there are a lot of these people out there. And, you know, honestly, it's maybe a little bit of an exaggeration, but they're almost scams. Okay. Mm. They're like Ponzi schemes. So there's a classic company. I'm not going to name the company. But there's a company that will basically show up to your office. You know, the CEO will show up, the CTO, CMO will show up, and they'll be wearing suits and they'll talk the talk. And they'll say, we're going to build you an OBL. It's going to be beautiful, you know. And then they basically want 51% equity in your OBL. So, yeah, no, seriously. And it's like, that's, you know, if you think about it, that's crazy. They're not building you an OBL. They're building the OBL and you're an employee of their OBL.
Yeah.
Right?
It's the same thing as falling into the cog.
But that's,
yeah.
Is that all? Because I know some, I was actually talking to one of the vascular surgeons I really knew well, an independent guy in San Antonio. We just started, he was sending me a patient and we're just, you know, started talking about other stuff. And he went solo. And he partnered with a local company from New Braunfels here. And from what I understand, it's not an equity play. So I think there's some degree of fee. And then they help you, you know, get an office manager and train them. And then that office manager helps then hire your office manager, that's your employee. And then they just kind of like, you know, kind of teach you the ropes as you go along. I'm sure there's a fee.
So look, what an ex-girlfriend told me, you never get something for nothing.
No, you have to pay.
Everything in life comes at a cost.
Yeah.
There are going to be management companies that what they do is they want to manage your project. So they'll take a, you know, percentage off the top of everything, right? But it's off the top, right? So before it ever gets to any point where you get anything, and, you know, remember that big number at the beginning becomes very shrunk fast. Yeah.
So they take a portion of the gross.
Correct. Gross collections. Then there's...
It's always gross.
There's and then you have these then intermediate models where it's like, okay, well, we'll take an equity and we'll manage. Mm-hmm. So then the negotiation begins and said, you say, okay, well, I'll give you 10% equity for a 4% management fee, or, you know, all these iterations. And some are as bullish as coming to you and saying, listen, you don't have to even do anything. All you have to do is be a doctor, focus on patient care, because that's what you do better. And numbers are so complicated for you. You're so dumb. Yeah. That we need to help you, and all of us three-letter people, CEO, CTO, COOs, dumb fuck, left and right. All of us, all we do is help you do what you can't do because you can't read an Excel spreadsheet. And so for that, you give us 51%.
Yeah. So that's you know exactly
what?
Right.
Yeah. So what did you do? Yeah. You didn't hire any outside consulting?
None.
You just...
None. Nothing. So the first group that I met with was... The first company I met with, they said, okay, we'll do everything for you 51%. I was like, that's crazy. I was like, that's insane. Like, that's, get out. The next company I met with was, we'll do everything for you. It's going to cost $100,000 in consulting. And I was like, that sounds more reasonable. You don't have any equity, but, you know, I don't have $100,000. So I can't do that. I'm sorry. Get out. So
next.
The next option was industry. So device manufacturers, you know, it's in their interest that you start an OBL because you're going to buy their stuff, right? you talk to some of these device manufacturers, Boston is a big one. They'll basically send a guy to you to just help you, consult, tell you what to do, essentially for free. But you have to commit to only using Boston products in your OBL for X number of years. And I knew the play here. The play was we build the OBL and then we price gouge the shit out of you for our atherectomy device, right? That's what they wanted to do. So I said, no, thank you. And what I did is I didn't know how to do it, but I just started doing it anyways. Okay. You know what I mean?
It's like sex. Yeah. Like, nobody teaches you how, but somehow you figure it out.
It's like your first Lego set. You're like, as a kid, you're putting the pieces together.
It's a more PC.
And you're like,
way.
You know what? Yeah, this doesn't really look right. You don't take it apart. You try it again. Yeah. Oh, now it looks more like the picture.
Yeah.
Right? And here's the crazy thing. It's not that hard. It's just not that hard. Okay? Now, I don't know about other states, but in California, an OBL is kind of an extension of your office. It's not like an ambulatory surgery center. You don't need all this crazy credentialing.
It's most places. Mm-hmm. It's a site of service 11.
Yeah, most states are like that.
It's a site of service 11. Yeah. It's just an added, you just roll in a C-arm, essentially.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, the California does have some strict rules about radiation.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to hire a physicist. You know, I had to see what my floor was made of. Is it concrete? Is it plywood? You know, to see, you know, how much radiation shielding you need and all these different things. That was the hardest part, the radiation related things. But other than that, it was not nearly as hard as these companies will make you believe. You know, they want you to think it's hard.
Yeah.
They want you to think it's really hard because that's where they're making money. The harder you think it is, the more money you're willing to pay them. It's not that hard.
And
you buy a C-arm, you do negotiations with GE for the C-arm. You know, you do negotiations with Boston and all these companies to put stuff on your shelf. And then the radiation stuff, you hire a physicist to do some of the radiation stuff. It's not that expensive. And then you're kind of done.
And did you have an idea of what the market costs were? Because I'm sure none of these companies are going to be upfront about,
of course,
you know, what they charge somebody else and another OBL for a balloon versus what they're going to charge for you. I'm sure they're going to start way higher. How did you inform yourself about that?
The key was I worked at another OBL.
Mm.
So I worked at an OBL that was not run by a proceduralist. This OBL was run by nephrologists. Mm. So when I started working there, I became more and more involved in the negotiations with the device manufacturers. So I had a really good idea of how much I should be paying for closure device, balloon, atherectomy, all of these things. But even if you don't do that, even if you don't know that, it's all about competition. You know, you get a quote from one company, you get another quote from another company, you get a third quote, and then you say, listen, guys, this is the best deal I have. Whoever beats this is it.
Yeah.
And then they give you their best deal and you start it over. You say, you know what? I know that's your best deal, but this other guy gave it to me for cheaper. And you just keep going and going and going. There's a company called Vascular Access. It's like the Amazon or Temu of OBLs. You can get a balloon for $60. Their wires are $15. So yeah, it's not that great, but that's your negotiating chip. You go to Boston and you say, you know what? Give me the best price. You know, that's not good enough. Vascular Access has a $15 wire. You know, Vascular Access is, they're a great company. Their products are actually okay.
Yeah. Vascular Access. And then the other one that I would advise you to look into is called US Endovascular. US Endovascular is also a nice one.
I think that a huge thing for me, and it's not a huge thing, it's just a small, it's just, fuck, I love a Glide Advantage.
So what? Just order them.
Glide Event. Aren't they like super expensive though?
Yeah, no. But I mean, you're not going to use them in every case.
I use them in every fucking case.
I use it in every case. At in the my OBL? OBL.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's the one thing I splurge on.
Look at you living it up. Yeah. Yeah. Better than Navicross.
Yeah. No, no Nanny Cross.
No, no, no. Fuck that. Yeah.
That's too much.
See, I splurge on Navicrosses.
You do?
Yeah.
But not on Glide Advantages?
Yeah. It's a dumb wire.
Oh, it's the best wire.
Sure.
I just use my balloons as the catheter.
Yeah.
You know, the one part that I would bring attention to, and obviously this may be accelerating and kind of getting close to the end of the hour we wanted to share with you, Jerry. But the one thing that I do believe that you have a little bit less control and less, and it's less easy, is revenue cycle management and getting the dollars actually in the kitty. So
expand on that. What do you mean?
All right. So for you to, you know, we just heard how complex it is to start the practice. You get a new TIN, you have to enroll with Medicare. That's kind of like the first step. Then you start building your contracts. Getting to the contracts is the whole nightmare, but then you start moving along. You maybe join some physician organizations, IPAs. That gets you access to other contracts and you start moving. Now you have the thing. Then we started saying, hey, you can build it. You can build it yourself. You don't have to make it overly complicated, especially if you want to do an OBL in this way. But then you start working and then you're busy. Okay. You're busy, you know, 5 days a week, 7 days a week. I mean, look, Jerry's wearing his scrub today. He's on call. And as you're working and as you're creating all these things, all that is flowing through a system that has all these checks and balances. And it's called claims. And every single claim is a world of errors waiting to happen. And so, you know, something as simple as the wrong date of birth gets put in a claim. And let's say it's a $16,000 claim. That claim goes, nope. And then the question is, who's there to see that claim go no, to then dive into the claim, to scrub the claim, to realize what the problem was, and then to resubmit the claim.
Do they tell you what the problem was that they...
It does, but it takes somebody doing that. And so then that's where some companies offer that service. But that's where I say you have to, as a private practitioner, if you want to make it, you have to splurge on your RCM person. That's the one person, you know, I think you can divest yourself out of a lot of things.
Yeah.
But the one thing that you want to internalize is who's going to follow the money. Who is the one that's going to follow every cent and that cent comes back? Because also, let's say that you got that patient pre-authorized
mm-hmm.
for tibial intervention. And then when you went in there, there's a popliteal stenosis that everybody missed. And you can't do the tibial intervention in CLI unless you touch that popliteal. Well, you just added a code that wasn't pre-authorized. And you may have just used a device or two that weren't pre-authorized, meaning you're not going to get paid for that code. And then what happens is the claim will go through, but you bill $20,000 and then they send $12,000. Well, there's a delta of $8,000. You're like, why is there a delta of $8,000? So somebody has to look at it and be like, wait, there's these CPT codes that you put in your note and they only paid two CPT codes. So now we have to figure out why. And the reason they'll say like, oh, there wasn't enough data in your note to support the fact that you did this additional stuff. And so then you have to amend your note and then you have to resubmit the claim with the new note so that the new claim brings back. But the thing is that when you don't do that, you become highly unprofitable. That's what makes it or breaks it in private practice. You know, you can get busy by doing marketing. You can do other. But if at the end of the day, you're busy, you're doing case list and right, the money isn't coming in. You're like, what the fuck is the money?
Yeah.
You're working your ass off and you look at the bank account and it's like $200 came in from Medicare. What?
Yeah.
Where's the $12,000 or the $20,000 that I was expecting, right? I mean, Jerry, what have you done in your practice for that? Like last mile, that seems to me the most complex part of this whole thing.
Correct. I totally agree with you. This is a huge problem. Like one example, I had a guy I did in my OBL, foot gangrene, SFA, pop, tibial. I put two stents, atherectomy on two territories. It looked beautiful. It looked so amazing. And I called the podiatrist and I said, man, this guy's going to heal his gangrene. I promise you. Turns out this patient didn't have Medicare Part B. He only had Part A and somebody missed it. So all of that was charity work. Which is great. You know, he's gonna heal the foot, he's doing well, but it was literally charity work. You know, the $3,000 in supplies that I spent, $2,000 on personnel, office, CRM, it was all gone. My time, it's all gone. It was all free for this guy. Just because one person missed it, they didn't see that he didn't have Medicare Part B. He only had Part A. Another example, you know, I signed this contract with this group called Village Health. They promised me 120% of Medicare rates for an entire year and a half. For some reason, I decided to look into it. Turns out they were paying me 60% of Medicare the whole time. You know, these are the things that destroy your practice. This is the reason people go bankrupt. Yep. I've seen it.
Yep.
You know,
yep.
And it's just really tough. It's really tough. But so
what's the solution?
My solution is extremely atypical. I do it myself. Okay. I have a spreadsheet. I keep every claim, every dollar that comes in, every dollar that is owed, and I keep track of it myself. I, you know, arrange the rows based on amounts, and then I hit the high dollar amounts every now and then. I look into it, sit down with my billers and say, what's going on here? You know, that's what I've been doing myself. But it's true. When I get busy, sometimes I go a month or more without checking in on these things.
Yeah.
And then I come back to it. And then some of these HMOs have like a 60-day rule. You're beyond the 60 days. You're not getting anything on that.
That's awesome.
You know? Yeah.
Timely claims.
Is it difficult to train someone to do that?
Like, you know, my philosophy is it's difficult to train anybody when it comes to money because it's not their money. It's your money, right? So you're the only one that really cares about it. Not only because it's your money, but it's your practice. You have to run payroll. You have to pay rent and all these credit card bills and things like that. The people who you hire don't care about those things. They have their own credit card bills to worry about. They're not worrying about your credit card bills. So
I think the biggest mistake is to marry somebody that can do that. I feel
that is true.
I'm not joking, man.
Correct.
The best offices I've seen are run by the wife.
Yeah, just put in a Hinge accountant, like just through your filters.
Bro, I'm telling you, listen, if Jenna had any interest in doing this and wanted to learn and felt comfortable, she would probably be the best because she would be hounding those numbers down all day long because it's in her best interest to our family to make sure that we get collections. Yeah. I've got multiple friends that they're like, you know, even if I ever dared like divorcing, I'm never going to do it because that she's the reason why our business is fantastic.
I'm just
putting it out there, but it's true that that's the one person that you, I mean, we hire somebody for that and I trust her very much, but I am on top of everything. Like I run reports every week. We have one hour a week allotted for those presentations. Mm-hmm. I have them running dashboards. There's multiple copies of Excel spreadsheets. I'm asking things. I'm like, what happened here? What happened here? What happened here? You left this money here. Like, how can there be timely? You have to look at your 30, 60, and 90 days. Like, what's your percentage of collections within those windows? And you don't want to let anything
pass
be past certain time because then they're like, untimely claim submission, done.
Yeah.
So imagine doing, you know, a super complicated case. Like, I mean, in Jerry's case, I'm glad the guy got what he needed to get, but he could have done it in the hospital, right? I mean, it's not like he was doing a disservice to the patient, but All right, Jerry, this has been, as always, incredibly fun. Man, I miss talking to you. I think you should come on the podcast more. Yeah. I think you would add a spice that would make it really fun. So whenever you're bored and you want to join us knuckleheads, you're always welcome to join our sessions and talk to different people in the world and learn from other people's mistakes and triumphs,
I guess. Yeah, we should bring Jerry in.
Yeah, this is an open invitation.
Yeah, I would love to come on.
You're just very easy to speak and you're also very colorful and you know, like you speak your mind and that's exactly what people like hearing.
Yeah, exactly. All right, cool. Well, that's great.
All right, guys. Yeah, well, thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure.
It is, right. Totally.
It's nice to see you again,
be in touch, man.
Yeah, I've been seeing you guys.
All right, brother. Pura vida.
Two vascular surgeons walk into a bar and come out with a podcast. We are talking everything vascular and not. Welcome to the Life of Flow podcast.